This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Scott Simon in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service may add polar bears to the endangered species list. At a news conference last week, the Secretary of the Interior announced that the bear's habitat, the polar ice, is melting away, meaning that climate change seems to be the culprit. Polar bears hunt for Arctic seals on floating patches of sea ice, and that ice is receding. Now, many conservation groups regard the announcement as a small but significant victory for their views. If the Department of Interior adds the polar bear to the endangered species list, it will be the first time that global warming is the primary reason a species has joined the list. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will conduct more research over the next year. Scientists will analyze more data. And in 12 months, the agency will announce its findings. The big, furry, blubberous, and iconic bears could join the ranks of threatened species. That already includes the African elephant, the koala, and the Nile crocodile. Joining us here in Studio 3A to talk about polar bears and climate change are two NPR reporters, Richard Harris, one of our science correspondents. Richard, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Elizabeth Shogren, who covers environmental issues.
Nice to be here.
And we invite you to join the conversation. Are you worried about the polar bear? What do you think ought to be done to curb global climate change? What can be done? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is talk@npr.org. Elizabeth, let me turn to you first. Do you read the same significance into this announcement that some environmental groups do?
The announcement is significant. I think there's a big question about whether or not things will go as far as they hope. I think on the extreme, they hope that what will happen is very simple, that the government will have to respond to the crisis that might face polar bears in the future. And the only way to respond is by dealing aggressively with climate change, and that means changing the way we use energy and reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Now, that seems like more of a reaction than I think will actually happen, but it remains to be seen whether this could be one of the many things that push the government forward to do more to respond to the challenge of climate change.
Richard, let me a basic question that maybe we need to renew every now and then. What is global warming? How much of it is just the natural result of more and more people living on the planet? And is it always necessarily harmful?
Well, clearly there are winners and losers in climate change, and polar bears seem to be quite possibly one of the big losers here if their habitat does continue to deteriorate and disappear. But global warming has been observed. Really, the whole planet would be hopelessly cold if it weren't some natural global warming here. We would be a frozen ice ball. But there's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that traps heat in the air the way glass keeps heat inside a greenhouse, so sometimes called the greenhouse effect. And human activities, burning fossil fuels, gasoline, coal, and so on, have put huge amounts of extra carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in the last several decades and centuries, really. It's gotten very noticeable in the last few decades. So what's happening is the world is accumulating this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. Physicists say this stuff does trap heat, and the Earth is getting warmer. On top of that, there are also natural cycles, so it's impossible to say exactly how much is human contribution and how much is a natural contribution to a, you know, possibly a several decades long heat wave. But clearly, the two are working in concert, and there is little debate that, in fact, the Earth has been warming up in recent decades.
Mm-hmm. I also read today that the number of polar bears has increased in recent decades. Is that a fact that is that defies what we're learning about their endangered habitat, Elizabeth?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed story. In the last couple of decades, there has been an increase in polar bears. That's in a response to the fact that killing them, the hunting of polar bears, has been regulated a great deal, and they've been protected a lot. The five countries that have polar bears in their areas, in their territories, have done a lot to protect polar bears. So their numbers have, over the last couple of decades, been improving. What's What has happened with a couple of the populations mm-hmm. is they have seen marked declines, and it, both in population and also in key indicators of whether a population is healthy. The population in the South Beaufort Sea, that's one of the U.S. populations of polar bears, one of the things scientists have noticed is that the rate of cubs surviving 1 year has declined rapidly. From 20 years ago, about 65% of the cubs who were born mm-hmm. survived through their first year. Now it's 40%. So that's pretty big decline.
Help us understand what happens to a polar bear cub that's born. Because when we say the ice is receding, I think a lot of people might say, well, my gosh, there are what, thousands if not millions of miles of ice and 2 or 3 inches a year even. We're talking about long-time survival, but what's happening to the health of cubs and others that are
in this population? One of the things about the South Beaufort Sea area where the polar bears are, the polar bears rely on ice. That's mm-hmm. where they do their hunting. That's where they meet their mates. That's where they rear their cubs. It's essential because that's where they find seals, which are their main prey. And what's happening now is that ice is receding farther and farther away from shore, and polar bears are finding it harder to get the seals that they need to eat. And so the polar bear cubs, the scientists surmise, are not getting the food that they need. And as the ice recedes further and further, it will be harder and harder for these polar bears to get the food that they need in a regular enough time. And the other problem that it's causing is because the gaps in the sea ice are greater, polar bears are having to swim longer distances than they're used to swimming. And there have been scientific studies that have shown that more polar bears are drowning because mm-hmm. they just can't make it through those gaps.
And I read today some polar bears have to swim 60 miles to find an ice floe.
It's true. And this is part of what the scientists talk about, that this is a great challenge to them being able to survive. It doesn't mean that these populations have disappeared, but mm-hmm. what the scientists believe is going to happen is that the polar ice will disappear or get smaller and smaller in the warm parts of the year, and that as a result of that, the polar bears will find it harder and harder to find spaces that they can live and adjust to, and then that's where the real threat comes.
Richard?
Yeah, this is also really partly a story about ice. The really dramatic change in the Arctic has been in the ice cover, which Elizabeth was alluding to. The ice usually covers about half of the Arctic Ocean mm-hmm. in the summertime, and in the wintertime it's fairly solidly ice, but the summertime is really where it matters. It shrinks back. But what scientists have noticed in recent years is the summertime extent of the ice has been shrinking very dramatically, not inches, but miles and miles. Mm-hmm. And there are some projections that by the middle of summer, that ice could shrink to the extent that it would essentially be a completely open ocean by 2040 or 2050 or something like that, if the current warming trends continue up there. And there's also a sort of a feedback, which is as the ocean, more ocean is exposed, more sunlight warms the ocean waters. The ice tends to reflect the heat back into space, but the ocean actually warms up when it gets hit by sunlight. So some people think this could be sort of a runaway effect where more open water begets more open water, and this whole process really accelerates. And so it's really it's the physics as much of as the biology, I think, that's mm-hmm. got people worried about the polar bear.
Well, then let me put a jump ball question up for either of you. Then we'll go to phone calls. If the United States were to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 25%, which in 1 year, which nobody thinks will happen, and I'm not even going to put India and China into the equation. Is there any reason to think that would restore polar ice cap?
None whatsoever, no. I think what we've seen is, for one thing, there's so much heat already stored up in the world's oceans from the carbon dioxide and the heat we've already accumulated in the planet that nothing is going to turn around quickly here. And so the hope for the polar bear really is that they're not threatened in the next 30 or 40 years, because we probably couldn't do anything about them if that were the case. But the thought is that maybe they aren't really threatened with extinction for a matter of centuries. And over that time scale, we can think about mm-hmm. making some changes. But even a fairly dramatic change in short order really won't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers now. James in Minneapolis.
Good afternoon. I'm not very smart, but I wanted to ask you, would it be possible to put out like floats of some type for these like little docks, for these animals to pull themselves up out of the water, whether in danger, it wouldn't endanger the environment or shipping or anything like that, but could you put out like some docks, some temporary floats for these animals to pull themselves up on. The other thing I wanted to ask you, why can't people ride bicycles? Why is it necessary that every human being on the earth has to be associated with a car? This is, I mean, it's not a very big thing to ride a bicycle where you have to go.
Hmm. James, you live in Minneapolis, which I know a city of 1,000 lakes and seems to be 10,000 bicycles. Do you have a car?
No.
So you ride a bicycle everywhere?
Everywhere.
Or a walk?
Well, I ride a bike. My legs ain't that good.
Well, but if you lived, say, in, I'll fill in the blank here. What if you lived in Edina and had to get to Minneapolis for your job? What would you do?
Well, I don't know, because that's not my case. But what I'm saying, sir, is that if you're going a long distance or a short distance, you can ride a bicycle. You can ride a bicycle. You don't need a car.
And what about those days in Minneapolis when it's, let's say, 5 degrees and snowing?
Well, if you dress warm enough, your body produces enough heat that your legs are going around, you'll stay warm. I mean, it's not really a problem.
Well, man of conviction. Let me get to Richard and Elizabeth to address your question. Thanks very much for calling, James.
I think bicycles are a great idea. I do ride my own bicycle, but I don't pretend that it's going to be a solution to climate change because there a lot of people do need to drive cars, too, as well. You want to take a stab at the docks?
The question of floats for polar bears, it's a really good question, and that you put that question up shows that you know a little bit about what the wildlife managers are going through. They're trying to think of something that will help this great mammal, and they can't come up with anything besides addressing the fundamental problem of climate change. Usually, when they address problems of a threatened animal, they can cancel logging, or they can tell somebody to stop polluting. But this is a very different kind of question. I asked one of the lead biologists on this issue whether or not you could just say move the polar bears to the Antarctica, where it is still quite cold. And he said, well, you could do that. You could move the polar bears there. They'd probably thrive, but they would destroy the ecosystem there. They wouldn't like the penguins or any of the other. The penguins wouldn't like it at all.
Okay. Polar bears are on thin ice, and when we return, we'll hear some creative solutions from within the energy industry, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-TALK, 800-989. I'll get this. I'm so sorry. 800-989-TALK. I'm going to call it myself. That way I'll remember it. I'm Scott Simon, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let me pick up our conversation here on the liquefying environment of polar bears. And Richard, you said that even if there were immediate dramatic results, nothing could probably be done to help these polar bears that are alive today. I wouldn't want to say nothing. They might not all be threatened. But
right. In the short run, because the climate moves at a very, very long scale, and it takes decades, if not centuries, for things to turn around. It's actually one of the big problems about global climate change is that our own human lives and our political lives tend to work on very, very short scales, and it's hard to convince people that they need to do something today in order to prevent something from happening decades from now. But that's exactly the situation we face with climate change. So we have to really, and it also means having to sort of be a little bit, I wouldn't say just entirely speculative, but say, look, we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but some possibilities are scary, and we have to think about those possibilities as serious possibilities. And if we're going to do something about them, we can't wait till they happen. We have to say, we on the best evidence, that we think that they could happen, and what can we do?
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, let me turn to you when we talk about some of the political implications, because there are people that seem to harbor some hope that essentially this puts the image of a polar bear on every hybrid car that's for sale in America. That somehow this is going to convince people in a way that other arguments haven't.
Well, I think the image of a polar bear is a powerful symbol. You know that just by looking at the advertisements in the wintertime. You can see polar bears everywhere advertising all different kinds of products. And that's because they think people like polar bears. And I guess people do like polar bears. And I think it is helpful to have something that's tangible, even if we don't all know polar bears. We know what they are. Mm-hmm. And that's why environmentalists think that this will help them as they try to persuade the public and the politicians to address the problem that, as Richard has just said, is something that people are not very inclined to do because it doesn't have a direct impact on their immediate lifestyle. And what the environmentalists are asking people to do really will have a direct impact on people's immediate lifestyles.
Well, like what?
Well, for instance, choosing to drive shorter distances because we don't want to use a lot of fossil fuels.
And choosing not to drive.
Choosing to drive shorter distance or not to drive at all, yeah. Or choosing not to use so much energy in our houses. I was just talking to a utility professional who was telling me that, in fact, people are using about 15% more energy from his utility in each and every house. Now, if we're going to keep doing that, those are not the ways that we're going to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. And people want to use more electricity. They want to have bigger televisions, and they want to have lifestyles that reflect their affluence. And that's why it's difficult, mm-hmm. I think, to make people change the way they want to live.
What about there's a new argument being made in behalf of nuclear power. People who say a generation has passed since Three Mile Island. There's all the arguments. There has not been an injury from the nuclear power industry in this country, and they say it's not only safe, but it is much safer to use than greenhouse gas.
Yeah, nuclear energy has the advantage of not putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, yeah. But it has the disadvantage of having nuclear waste, which is as much a political issue as a technical issue in this country. And the idea of trying to get new nuclear power plants sited is also very difficult because no one wants to live near a nuclear power plant. They don't care if Three Mile Island was so long ago, and people still remember Chernobyl, and people think about terrorist attacks from a few years ago and think, geez, could this be a target? So yes, in terms of from the standpoint of climate, if we could sort of switch away from coal and go more towards nuclear, that would be good for our atmosphere. But it's entangled with a lot of other issues that really makes it a difficult sell.
We want to take a call from Kieran. I hope I'm getting the pronunciation correctly, in Tucson.
Yes, that's right. Kieran, I'm with the Center for Biological Diversity. We're the group that filed the polar bear petition and the subsequent lawsuit to get the Bush administration to act. And you know, the reason we did that was because virtually all of the global warming political discussion today takes place in a realm that is thoroughly political, and that allows the administration to avoid, deny, or downplay the impacts of global warming. And the Endangered Species Act is very unique in that it insists that all decisions will be made exclusively on science. And so we move forward with the polar bear petition thinking this will force the administration into a position where it simply has to let the science do the talking, probably for the first time ever. And what we saw was, when squeezed into that box, the administration did admit to the reality of global warming. But what was even more striking about this decision was that while it acknowledged that global warming is occurring, the decision nowhere mentions at all the cause of global warming. No discussion of emissions, carbon, greenhouse gases, etc. It's as if the world were just heating itself up for no reason at all. And when prompted to explain that, the Secretary of Interior said, well, global warming is beyond the scope of the Endangered Species Act. Therefore, we're not going to discuss it whatsoever. And so what's happening here, we've kind of got a good news, bad news things going on, where they've admitted that global warming exists. It's driving the polar bear extinct. But at the same time, they're quite, I think, ridiculously trying to say, and furthermore, we will not allow the Endangered Species Act mm-hmm. to have any influence over global warming. And thus, we want to push it all back into the political realm and away from the scientific mm-hmm. realm.
Karen, let me ask, and I'm sure you've addressed this argument over the years that we often put to people in your position. Species go extinct all the time and have gone out of business all the time. We just didn't have their pictures on calendars for centuries, and that global warming has been going on for centuries, and that this is the nature of life on this planet. Some species are able to flourish, others disappear, and not all of it can be traced to factors that are within our control.
That's true. Extinction is a natural event. It's happened since the beginning of time, However, the current rate of extinction is extraordinary and beyond the bounds of anything we've seen in the last 65 million years when a comet hit the Yucatan Peninsula. So so we're very clearly in a human-caused mass extinction event. And similarly, with warming, yeah, the Earth has gone through warming and cooling cycles, many thousands and thousands of these cycles over the years. But what we're seeing now, again, is extraordinary. In the decision to propose the polar bear for listing, the Fish and Wildlife indeed states that what we're seeing in the Arctic has not occurred within the last 800,000 years. So we are going well, well outside the boundary of short-term kind of normal fluctuation events.
Kieran, thank you very much for calling. I want to get now to, from his office in Charlotte, North Carolina, is John Stowell, Vice President for Environmental Policy at Duke Energy. That's an energy company that serves 3.9 million customers in the Southeast and Midwest. Mr. Stowell, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
A quick question. How much of your power comes from coal versus nuclear or other sources?
Most of the power that we dispatch, which means what we send to our customers, is from coal, about 90%.
Hmm. And do you believe that global warming exists, global warming that's caused by human enterprise?
We do. We do not. We're real careful to mention that we're not scientists ourselves. However, we follow the science very closely, and particularly the National Academy of Sciences report, which agrees that climate change is occurring and that human action has a lot to do with it.
Mm. Mr. Stowell, does your company have plans to try and reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that it's putting into the air?
Yes, we have begun to reduce our what we call the intensity of our greenhouse gas emissions, which is the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted per megawatt hour. We're doing this on a voluntary basis because, as all your listeners know, there is no law which requires us to do so. And therefore, when we make these reductions, we're doing this on our own volition. And we think it's important that we get started with that policy now. At the same time, we are promoting Congress to pass a mandatory greenhouse gas plan within the next couple of years, we hope.
Mm. What about moving towards nuclear energy?
We have nuclear right now on the North Carolina side of our business. We operate in five states, mm-hmm. for your listeners, the two Carolinas, Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. And yes, we believe that nuclear is an important part of an overall energy strategy for this company and this country, and we are planning to build a new nuclear plant in the next decade.
Mm. Mr. Stowell, let me get you to stand by, and I want to bring the conversation back to polar bears. We've got a question now from Alex in Vancouver, Washington.
Yes, I have a quick question. If the polar bears have not evolved in the last 35,000 years, how did they survive earlier periods of warming?
Elizabeth?
Well, you might have exceeded my expertise in polar bears. I cover a huge array of issues. But it is true. I don't know exactly what they've done before. I'm guessing that their populations probably were centered on the places that still were frozen and where there still were seals, where they found their prey. And then when the climate was better, I guess they expanded out again. But I'm not sure. I don't have a deep enough expertise.
Centuries before the L.L. Bean catalog would have been available to them. Then all that thinsulate and everything. Well, good question. I wish we could handle it, but Elizabeth handles an awful lot. We'll find out what we can. Thanks very much for calling.
You're welcome.
We've got a call now from Chuck in San Francisco.
Thanks a lot. I've been kind of following this issue for a while and have been really interested in the energy industry's opinions on it. And it sort of goes from denying it was happening at all, saying it was happening but it was a good thing, saying it was happening, it wasn't entirely a good thing, but it was best to maintain our economic vigor and aid equatorial nations as a kind of a harm reduction strategy. And now it seems to be, it's happening, it's not a good thing, and we need to do something about it, but we ought to focus on other countries and not do anything here. And, you know, this has led to systems with, you know, like trading systems where we're essentially paying plants in China to reduce their emissions. And it seems to me we're going about the wrong way. What we need to do is first admit that there's a problem and lead by example by reducing our emissions. And rather than trying to give the technology to other countries, develop the technology here and perhaps do something about our trade deficit, because we need to kind of get the message out to everybody that everybody's got to address it, and then we can benefit economically when we provide the means to address the problem.
I'm going to ask John Stoll to maybe say something in reply, but first I want to tell everyone you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Stoll, can you make a response?
Well, the caller represents the Duke Energy position in climate change. We do believe that the United States needs to set an example, lead by example. And yes, there are a variety of different opinions within our own industry with regard to what to do about climate change, some of which the caller mentioned. The Duke Energy position, however, is that we need to get started now. In fact, we wish there was already a climate plan in effect, primarily because this company and many of the other companies in the U.S. are on the brink of constructing new generating facilities. We need to construct new generating facilities to meet the growing demand for electricity, and it's to our advantage and to our customers' advantage for us to know the rules of the road on what we have to do to comply with the emissions laws. Mm-hmm. That's why we think it's important from a business perspective to begin climate change, greenhouse gas reductions now. And obviously, from an environmental position, we believe that the science bears out that we need to get started sooner rather than later.
A quick question. Isn't, Mr. Stoll, isn't, and for that matter, Richard, Elizabeth, if you want to join in, isn't there, aren't there, billions of dollars to be made from the company that figures out a good, reliable, relatively inexpensive alternative fuel that can be used in automobiles?
Sure. Well, I think so. I think there are, I would hate to say billions, but I imagine that's the case. And alternative energies, renewables, energy efficiency, all of the products that can produce electricity that do so in a low or non-emitting way is really the wave of the future. And whoever can corner the market on that going to be rich.
Right. And there's different philosophies about how to get there. One philosophy says make it expensive to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that will create a very strong incentive for people to develop these technologies.
Like a carbon tax.
A carbon tax or a cap and trade program, something like that. Basically, if you create economic incentives, people will find the cheapest ways of accomplishing these things. Other people say, well, let's just go out and develop these technologies. And the Bush administration has put a lot of money, research dollars, a lot to me at any rate, into technology development, but has been unwilling to do the other part, which is to say, and it's going to be expensive if you don't do something with these technologies.
No, that's right. What's needed really is a long-term price signal for carbon to incentivize the development of technologies and the deployment of those technologies. You won't get that unless there's a greenhouse gas reduction program with a cap, a declining cap over time, with a long-term price cap. And we're talking about a price cap that would maybe go out 50 to 100 years, because this is a problem that is not going to be solved overnight. It's going to take some time.
I think in line with that, we have a call from Matt in Boston in our last minute and a half. Matt?
Yes, hello?
Yes, hi. You're on with Talk of the Nation. How are you?
Good. I just want to say that I have a comment on the global warming and all that. We're committed to at the very least, 100 years of global warming because of the anthropogenic injection of fossil fuels into the atmosphere. Excuse me, sorry, I'm catching my breath. And there's really nothing we can do except for some various geoengineering, options. And I'm just trying to express my support for adding the polar bears onto the endangered species list, because we, as the ice melts up there, the ground gets darker, the water gets darker, and it absorbs more heat, and the ice melts faster. And the polar bears are just going to lose more ice and become more and more endangered. So I'd just like to express my support for that.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for calling. Thanks for being with us.
Yep.
And Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent, thank you very much for being with us. Elizabeth, quickly, so over the next year there's a review, more tests, more findings?
More findings and a lot more on climate change from Congress, from the Supreme Court, and from maybe the White House.
Okay. Thanks very much, NPR's Elizabeth Shogrim. When we come back from a short break, Ken Rudin is going to kick off 2007 with us, another hit from our political junkie. I'm Scott Simon, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.